Call the House Committee on Health Care to order, at least a subset of us to order. The others are not very orderly.
Disorderly,
but I expect they'll be here shortly. Let me start with a couple of announcements. Madam Administrator, you have something to report.
I just want to note for the record that we have written testimony submitted by Steve Dixon, Advocacy Director of Oregonians for Health Security, that's on with your packets of material that we will be entering into the record.
And for others of you, if you just want to submit material for the record, we are happy to accept it. It's easiest if you send it to Sandy with a copy to me rather than sending it to me, because that takes one extra step, because I need to forward it to her. I also want to make an announcement for, I guess, our committee, not all quite here yet, an announcement that we have scheduled a hearing on three bills for Wednesday, right, in which Rocky King was going to come to testify. They're bills relating to the OMIP, to the high-risk pool. And Rocky is a little gimpy right now, so he's not going to be here with us. That's the 2192, 2193, 2194. We will have the first public hearing on 2058, which is the last of the suite of health licensing boards bills, and we'll also carry over the public hearing on 2009, on Section 20 of 2009, so we'll have more time for public testimony on that section of 2009 on Wednesday. So if we should have a fair amount of time to address that on Wednesday. We're going to have public testimony. Do I have the list? First name on the list I know is Dr. Bruce Goldberg.
Right.
Are you ready to go, sir?
Anytime you want.
Let's go. We'll do Dr. Goldberg first, Teresa Miller second, and Dr. John McConnell third.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bruce Goldberg. I'm the director of the Department of Human Services. I've been asked to come here today.
Hold on. Everybody, follow my lead. This cell phone, in it has a button that turns it off. Please take out your cell phones and turn it off, because even if it's silence, as we just heard, it screws up our recording system. You didn't want to take the call anyway, Bruce.
Ah, here, hold on.
The other one, too. The implant, you don't have to take it.
No, I just twitch when that goes off.
Yeah. All high-level people have an implant that the governor can go directly to, right?
Yeah, it's the one that makes me twitch. Chair Greenlech. You've asked me to come here today to testify whether I'm in favor or against House Bill 2009, and the answer is clearly yes. Having said that,
you sign on as a co-sponsor then.
Yes. No, I've been asked to come here today to give...
I didn't do that, right? Be truthful.
That's correct. I actually have been asked just to provide some thoughts from the perspective of the director of the State's Department of Human Services about this bill. And to be clear, and actually to be very serious, I didn't come here today to take an opinion one way or another, but to really walk through some of the perspectives about the bill, and particularly around the creation of the Oregon Health Authority. I think, as everyone on the committee knows, this bill does a number of things. You know, it creates a healthcare quality institute, a health insurance exchange. It increases tobacco tax and sets out the use of those dollars, creates a tax on hospitals and health insurers, managed care plans, and provides for the use of those dollars. It expands health care coverage for children and adults. And it's none of those things that I'm really going to talk about, because each one of those on their own, I think, are a serious and a major form of conversation. What I am here to talk about is a little bit about the Oregon Health Authority. And I think, as everyone on the committee knows, the major goal of House Bill 2009 is to establish a singular board and a state agency focused on both setting and implementing overall state policy for health and healthcare in Oregon. And this is certainly a goal I think we can all support. You know, the issue is, how do you achieve that? Because it can be done in a number of ways. And it's really the latter issue, the creation of the Oregon Health Authority, that I'm going to talk about today. And rather than debate policy, what I'd like to do is to provide some thoughts from a number of different perspectives. You know, first is from the perspective of citizens, clients, those who would be served by a new health authority. Second is the providers of those services, doctors, nurses, all sorts of people that provide those services. Third is from the perspective of how one administers anything that we do in a state as complex as health and human services. And four is from a policy perspective. So let me start first with clients. For clients, there's certainly a need to assure that services are integrated on the ground from a number of perspectives. There, I believe, needs to be a singular place for access for eligibility, regardless of what those services are. So whether we're talking about mental health, food stamps, child care, unemployment insurance, the array of human services and family supports that we provide as a state, whether now done by a singular agency or, as I've indicated, a number of the ones I've spoken about are right now administered by a variety of agencies. I think that there's a need to unify those on the ground. And quite frankly, as we look into the future, that might not be a bricks and mortar place. But if we look out into a future of how to access eligibility, we may be looking at a future where clients access those at home electronically. That's certainly something that we're working at in the Department of Human Services, is not looking at a building, but actually looking at ways citizens can access services from their own home, where their family members, perhaps from across the country, can help them access things. But I think the key here is that there's a real need to look at the eligibility function and being certain that that's integrated on the ground. And I think that can be done in a variety of ways and in a variety of structures. There's another perspective from those of citizens, which is the provision of health care. And I think certainly that's both an individual issue as well as a larger policy issue. We're looking at ways to right now look at how we can integrate mental health, substance abuse, and addiction services and be certain that they're better integrated, looking at issues such as primary care homes, assuring that public health goals are met both through larger state public health policy as well as through the delivery of individual care. But I think it's those issues that need to be considered. For providers, there are some different considerations. Certainly, being able as a state to consolidate contracting and payment in one entity is a laudable goal. There are states that have payment and finances run by organizations outside of the policy arms and the programmatic arms, but have centralized fiscal and financial services for a variety of things. I think it would also be beneficial for providers of service to have, from a state perspective, a singular point of not just fiscal administration, but quality oversight. Looking at today, where certainly I know as a physician that we have multiple organizations, health insurers, state, different state programs, looking at a whole variety of different quality indicators, looking at how we assure quality, what better way than to assure a consolidated way that we as a state collect information and assure that quality services are being provided in a way that has a singular focus. Probably easier said than done, but certainly a laudable goal. From an administrative perspective, it makes sense to put together those services that are interdependent. It makes sense to pool states' purchasing power to be able to buy the right health care, to assure that the health care system does what it needs to do to meet our public health goals and vice versa. And then lastly, from a policy perspective, the state needs to have a unified focus about how we work on improving health care, and more importantly, the focus really needs to be about improving health. Not about improving health care, but the state needs to look at how we, from a unified policy perspective, improve the health of our citizens, reduce the costs of health care, and I think lastly, as a piece of the other two, provide the kind of administrative simplification which is been a long time coming within the healthcare and human services arena, whether from the perspective of those that deliver or those that receive services. So those are, I think, some of the ways that when I've looked at this bill, you need to approach it. And I think practically there are a number of other considerations and choices. I mean, what this bill does is it really splits off health from the human service piece of the Department of Human Services. It creates one agency, the Oregon Health Authority, that houses health, mental health, addictions, public health. It adds some other agency functions that currently are not within the purview of the Department of Human Services. And it leaves the Department of Human Services responsible for what are primarily social services such as food stamps and TANF, Temporary Aid to Needy Families, the care of persons with disability, responsibility for child welfare, and senior services. And the senior service piece now leads me to a couple of other considerations and thoughts about the bill. Because when we look at senior services, one of the largest senior services that we provide as a state is long-term care. And that creates sort of an interesting split between whether one views long-term care as what could be considered a social service, or one views long-term care as acute care. My answer to that is similar to my answer to whether I support or am against House Bill 2009, which is yes. I mean, I think certainly creating those sorts of dichotomous views as to how you view something like long-term care, quite frankly, means we'll never figure our way out of it. If on one hand we don't understand that individuals need long-term care, the assurance that they have a place to live that meets their social and health care needs, and that also they have acute health care, they go together, And whether they're as part of the same agency or not, I think the more important issue is how we as a state come to an understanding that all these things are inextricably linked. And part of what we need to do is create new sorts of organizational ways of looking at the provision of these services as opposed to whether or not you're just in or out of an organizational structure. You know, to give you a sense, right now long-term care is approximately 40% of our state's Medicaid expenditures. Likely, given the aging of our population, that long
the disabled, the developmentally disabled section as well.
Is a piece of Sierra Green Lake is a piece of that as well, and a large part of our expenditure on the care for developmentally disabled persons is funded through Medicaid as well, and so we've got to figure out ways to continue to deliver services concurrently, whether or not they're part of the same agency or not. You know, another piece is separating out the eligibility from the delivery of services. What this bill would do would be to, in essence, have one agency which is responsible for the eligibility for health services, some health services, and another responsible for the policy and programmatic implementation. Quite frankly, that's what we do within the Department of Human Services today, which is the eligibility function is delivered through the Children, Adults, and Families Division, which has field offices that whereby clients come in and can access a variety of services from the department. But the programmatic pieces, like the health plan, are administered by, you know, a different agency within the department. And then the last piece that I just touch on and then open it up for questions is one of timing and planning. And I think that one of the most important things to consider in a bill like this is to have the appropriate time to plan and create whatever kind of a statewide administrative infrastructure the legislature chooses to do. And I believe that that's at least 1 to 2 years to be able to plan and implement that. When I took over the role as head of the Department of Human Services, it's now 3 years ago. At that point, the department had, about a year and a half previously, had reorganized itself and was in a bit of a financial crisis because of, I believe, the what was a reorganization on paper. It was a new way that we drew the boxes and in some way programmatically delivered the services. But the wiring behind it wasn't changed. It was sort of as if you took these light fixtures and moved them around, but didn't change all the wiring that connected them and the switches, that many of the fiscal and administrative functions in the department are intertwined. And I believe that it's very these things can be separated out, and I believe that with the appropriate time and planning it can happen, but the issue is to provide the appropriate time frame and planning to do that. I believe that we'll be in a better place as an agency over the next year or two to make the kind of a change that this bill calls for, should that be the wish of the legislature. We've been working on, in essence, rationalizing the organization from the bottom up, and I believe that's what then makes the kinds of changes in organizational structure much more amenable to being done. But one needs the time to do that, and I think the last comment I would make would be also around timing, which is when you look at this bill and you look at, for instance, the several healthcare functions which are combined with several current DHS functions to create the healthcare authority, you could move those into the Department of Human Services, and then you could split into two new agencies. You could do all of that at one time. I think there's a variety of ways that you could do this. I think the issue is being certain that there's the appropriate time and planning to do that. So with that as some thoughts, let me stop. Hopefully I've precipitated some thought and maybe some questions.
Questions? Yes, sir.
What do you want? Whoever wants to go first.
Let the vice chair go first.
How is this going to work today? Because I don't want to take time away from people who want to present.
Well, I think we have Bruce with us who has a special insight. He'll be happy to come back. But I think it would be pretty useful to ask him whatever makes sense to ask in terms of... Okay. Of the mechanics of what we're talking about, I think. And then after that, Teresa Miller is going to talk about particularly the relationship with DCBS and some ways to deal with the models we're talking about. And then we're going to have Dr. McConnell talking about modeling some of the cost consequences of the provider tax, because it's a good thing to do today. But no, so I would say you should ask Dr. Goldberg whatever is in your mind.
Dr. Goldberg, This split, to me, actually, it makes sense to split this, say, the social services from the healthcare, because healthcare is overriding the economy in such a grand form. And have you thought about right when the rubber hits the road, the practicality of doing the split, and what major issues you see? I know you've addressed. You know, long-term care. I'm not ready for that yet. Public health, and you know, where do these things come together? And at the end of the day, how many FTE do we add? Because sometimes you can't break that linkage. So, have you thought about some of these like really nitty-gritty details? Are you beginning the planning process to move in that direction?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Maurer, members of the committee, I'm at the very beginning stages of really thinking about this. I mean, I think, like anything else, this is serious consideration, and the department stands ready to provide that level of analysis, and we're beginning to look at that. We've really only had the bill for a week or two, have begun to really start to think about those kinds of things. I believe that some of those questions will, quite frankly, be best addressed over what would be a year-long planning process. In terms of issues like FTE, we haven't done any kind of an analysis. It would be my sense and my expectation that a change such as this wouldn't change the numbers of FTE, that there would be ways to move the FTE around that made sense. But we haven't gotten close to where we could provide an analysis of that. So I think that to me some of the bigger issues are not as much the FTE as some of the information system infrastructure and ways that would be handled.
You talked about the possibility of sharing services between the old agency and the new without trying to reconstruct it twice. Could you comment on that?
Chair Greenlick, we've begun to bat around some ideas of exactly that type of a model. I'll give you some examples where right now We've been working hard on a financial management infrastructure and a budget process. One could look at ways that one agency could contract with another for shared services and be able to do that. It's my sense, quite frankly, that there are probably many more opportunities within all of state government, not just within the Department of Human Services, to look at sort of shared service models and economies of scale for some of the functions that make sense to share that are generic, such as some of the IT, some of the HR, and some of the functions of government that I think are fairly generic regardless of what agency you're in. So we've begun to think about how you could do that between two agencies instead of splitting everything in half. There's certainly some ways to be able to look at new and different ways to do that.
President Cannon?
Thank you.
President Bruin?
Thank you, Dr. Goldberg. And I really appreciate your openness and your candor and I think your creativity when it comes to this issue. It would be very easy for an agency director facing a bill like this to perhaps in coded language or perhaps not send some very strong signals that this is not what we should be considering. And I'm not hearing that from you. I'm hearing a willingness to at least engage in the contemplation of what this new world would look like. And I appreciate that a great deal. I wonder if you have any experience, personal or otherwise, with departmental reorganization along the lines of what this bill anticipates. How thin is this ice that we would be skating out onto?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, members of the committee, let me give you a historical perspective. When I took over this role 3 years ago, I looked back as to the history of the Department of Human Services and saw that the department had organized and reorganized probably every 4 to 5 years beginning in 1960. And it's a great presentation, and I'll actually be very... I will get it's a PowerPoint. I'll get a copy to Sandy, and just to, I think it's a great, if nothing else, a sense of history of state government. The Department of Human Resources used to have within it the Department of Corrections. That before it was the Department of Human Services, it was the Department of Human Resources,
right.
And within that was the Department of Corrections, the Employment Department. I've tried to figure out what wasn't in it at that point. And it's been organized and reorganized numerous times over the last about 40 years and probably before that. I think that the issue is not so much organizing or reorganizing for the sense of reorganizing, but it's to really have a sense of the policy objectives that the state wants. And I'm not saying that to try and avoid the question. I think that if you look across, so first off, that's the history of the department. I've looked across the nation and meet periodically with my counterparts from across the nation, and it's fascinating. I don't think there is a single state that is organized in the same way. So certainly if someone had found the answer, we would all be, or maybe 20 of us would be doing that. But they're organized in a variety of ways. Some look more like others. Some, there are health authorities that combine some of the health functions here, like I believe it's Oklahoma or Arkansas that does that. There's others that have large umbrella departments like ours with everything in it. There's everything in between. And there are states that continue to look for the right configuration based on a variety of things. I think that reorganizing is the right thing to do if it's being done for the right reasons, and that there's a common sense of why that's being done and the appropriate time. It's hard for me to sit here and be able to say there's the perfect way to do something. But by the same token, I'm not here to say the status quo is also the best way to do things as well. I think part of what we're all here to do is to be creative and to think about these problems. And, you know, again, to me, the one issue is the appropriate time and planning. And I also believe a sense of, I think, consistency of vision for government. One of the most difficult things can be to have a sense of consistency of vision that changes in 2 years, and that sort of whipsaws not just agencies, but clients and everybody else. And so it's really, I think, creating a common vision of how we want to organize state government and then, you know, moving forward with that. And I think that that's what needs to drive this. And I don't know whether that really answered your question or not.
Thank you. If your job was cut in half, is your salary going to be cut in half?
Only if you do that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and he's being a little bit cynical, but that's kind of my question, in a much more delicate fashion, which is this. Of course, following from Representative Maurer's questioning as well. Obviously, a lot of what DHS does now, and first of all, thank you for being here again, like it was said earlier. A lot of what DHS does now with the establishment of the health authority, from my vision, it would be extraordinarily difficult to just turn off, okay? And so my fear is that you have redundant systems when we don't necessarily need redundant systems. And just a quick analogy, maybe too far out, but just hopefully not. U.S. Coast Guard, okay, was under the Navy Department during World War II. When the war ended, okay, it went under the Department of Transportation. Then in 2002, we get the Department of Homeland Security. Okay, the Coast Guard goes under there. What they've discovered is that there's a whole lot of costs that were related to the Coast Guard that are still embedded in the Department of Transportation, even though the Coast Guard is no longer at the Department of Transportation. That's my fear with these massive new agencies that we're building, and I don't really expect an answer. I mean, it's too early for that, other than to get the fear on record, and to realize I think it's a real problem. It's probably a real opportunity too. DHS is, you've done a phenomenal job of managing DHS, but DHS is in effect Oregon's Pentagon. It is big, it does a lot, and it's hard to see what's in there. And so maybe taking such a big function as healthcare and carving it out may help us understand and get our arms around DHS even a little better. So that was more comment than question, but I'd love to hear your response to it.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bruin, you know, I think you have a reason to be, you know, fearful of that redundancy. I think that oftentimes there is certainly in state government, as in many other organizations, you know, a sense that it's size that matters. And where people often, many times, folks who administer programs look at their ability to get things done based on the size of their budgets and the numbers of personnel that they have. You know, that creates, I think, sometimes some real conflicting agendas. I think that there is often a lack of transparency that certainly, you know, I don't believe is always purposeful, but sometimes based on some of the complexity of our organizations, it's hard sometimes for people to really, you know, open up the hood and understand what's there. You know, 40 years ago, you could pop the hood of a car and it all made a whole lot of sense, and today it really doesn't. It's very complex. I think having said that, I think that if approached in the right way, in an open and a transparent manner, where many of the assumptions are indeed questioned, that you can make a change like this without that kind of redundancy. You know, I would say that right now we have some of that redundancy within the agency as it exists, and we're working really hard to do away with that. That's been part of our organizational transformation process, is to, I think, part of any organization should be that ability to, you know, eliminate waste, look at ways to do things most efficiently, you know, question how you're organized, be able to respond to new technological or organizational or policy developments. And I think if you go into this with that kind of a framework and put it all on the table, you can you won't have that kind of a redundancy. And in fact, you may have something that's better, more efficient, and more effective. But it is certainly, I mean, I think that those kinds of issues exist right now within the agency as it's currently configured. And our job, I think my job as an administrator of an agency and your job as policymakers is for us to work together to make certain those don't happen regardless of what structure we're in.
Thank you. Representative Kotek and Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Bruce. I guess I just wanted to make a comment. I think having lived through the reorganization on the other side as an advocate, I don't think any of us are interested in necessarily moving the deck chairs around just for the sake of doing that. I think, unfortunately, though, and I know that 2009 is a first draft, but I think we're being limited by the language and the idea that we're talking bricks and mortar. And I think what excites me about the health authority is that it's a new way of looking at how health is promoted in this state in a really coordinated way. And I think the Health Fund Board, really their goal was looking at the landscape of everything out there. There was no one-stop place where someone was going to say, when DCBS, for example, in the insurance division, makes a choice around plans, that somehow affects our goal as a state in terms of promoting health. When public health makes a choice over in DHS, how does that relate to everything else? How does what happens in the Office of Private Health Partnerships, how does that affect? And I think that's what they were trying to get at. And I would hope that if our vision is to centralize decision-making, but maybe not the functionality of what happens, I think that's what we're trying, at least in my mind, that's what we're trying to achieve. And I think, unfortunately, I think what we're seeing in the bill is very much like we're going to create a new agency. And I don't think that's the goal, but it is, that's the way it looks right now. And so my goal is not that. It's how do we have intentionality around health and promoting health in the state, and how do we get there? So I know you do some of that in your department, but other places do as well. I don't really have a question. I just wanted to put that out there.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kotek, I think you've probably stated more articulately than I how you need to approach this. And I think that's exactly it. It's having a, one, what are you trying to achieve? And I think when I read through the bill, the what we're trying to achieve is a singular place where responsibility for health and health policy is located, and where you can put your finger on it, and you can not only put your finger on it and touch it, but that there's some accountability there for what happens. I think that having that accountability and is key. Having said that, then how you do that underneath that, and how you organize things, the choices are as infinite probably as our imaginations, and I believe that's the way to approach this, is not simply being about how do you either separate or add to a state agency. And it's interesting because, you know, I think that some of the stages that you go through when you start to look at this bill in our agency, you know, the first reading instilled fear in everybody because it meant change. And it was, am I in or out? What does this mean? All of that. And I think as people work their way through that, they start to say, huh, well, and I think there's just a lot of different ways you can look at this, but it really does start with that, where's that accountability for health in this state? And it's certainly one of the things I can't put my finger on as we're organized today.
I think there is an issue with the size of an agency, actually. I've in my one of my past lives taught organizational theory, and there's a story in organizational theory about you have to dig a hole, and you get two people in there digging the hole, and it's not coming fast enough, so you put two more people in to dig a hole. Now you have four people, and they're all working. Somewhere along the line, you get enough people into that hole that everything slows down rather than speeds up. And at some point, you start losing the productivity per person, and eventually, you lose the total productivity. I think, frankly, by the end of my first session here, I was convinced DHS is simply too big to manage. And, I mean, that's just an opinion, and Bruce and I have actually discussed it over time. There's no real answer, but sometimes in organizational theory, and in business that happened frequently, you would combine companies, and it just wouldn't work. And then somewhere along the line, you had to split them back up to get efficiency rather than, you know, you have disadvantages of scale rather than advantages of scale. Representative Thompson.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think we read the same book. I've experienced that in big corporation settings where bigger is certainly not better, nor is it more profitable. And I agree that we may be here, you know, a little bit with what we've done with DHS. But my concern is we're in I'm not going to use the term fiscal crisis position. We're in an uncomfortable economic period right now. And my friend Paul Warner keeps coming by giving me little tidbits of information that leaves me somewhat more unsettled than yesterday. So we're in a tough row. Chances are you're not going to get your dream budget for the next biennium. We'll work on it, but, you know, just the way it is. On top of that, changes in Washington, D.C. are hopefully going to generate changes in healthcare attitude, and it looks like you may be getting additional funds for client services, probably not expansion of the department, but you at least get client service money out of it. And I'm a little concerned that all of this coming down at one time impacts what I believe you referred to as timing. Mm-hmm. Is there a way that we might be able to segment this and phase it in incremental changes within the department for, let's say, over the next 2 years, with the goal of coming out the other end with a split department? I mean, we know some of the things we want to happen, some of the efficiencies we're looking for, redesign of healthcare delivery, things like that. I'm just concerned that this is not the time to launch a major new department, and part of it's fear of change, I admit that, and all of a sudden we're going to get healthcare nirvana by the next time we come together in the next legislative session or sometime like that. This is going to take a while, and maybe if we ease into it and it can identify segments that we can expect to accomplish within 2 years that are under the umbrella of the overall design, we might have something more manageable. I don't even know what the question was. I guess I'm asking you to comment on that.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Thompson, that's exactly what I was going to say, is that I think that what I had indicated is my biggest fear was there being a mandate to do this in 6-8 months, yeah. And I think it's
that long.
it's really laying out the appropriate process and indeed some of the decision points along the way, and that may be in some ways the way to approach this. Again, not as well. you know, either or, in or out, one or the other, but how would we approach this? How do you, what are some of the decisions that need to get made? I think we've touched on some of them today around, you know, shared services and infrastructure versus policy and program, and to look at what we're trying to achieve and map that out and be able to come up with, in essence, what that plan is. And then you can break ground, and then you can start to do what's needed to be able to, you know, build what it is you want to build.
Yeah, we also have the problem, the extent to which you put something in statute rather than set an objective and say this should happen by this time frame, yeah, and give the managers a chance to work it out.
Representative Maurer?
I think.
Yes, thank you.
And then Representative Dembra.
I don't see, I mean, the conversation seems to be about rearranging the deck chairs. And I really don't think this conversation is about rearranging the deck chairs, because the language of the bill is not about, the conversation is not about splitting DHS. That's an internal question within state government. Big question, no doubt, but it's just, you know, outside doesn't see it. I mean, this is a shift in power by the language of the bill. And there are, you know, section after section where the shift from the status quo with the inertia going toward government control is clear in the words that are written on the page. And so I am less concerned about, you know, that we're not doing this for an efficiency in state government. We're doing this for a change of structure in an entire segment of our GDP in the state of Oregon, our entire economy. So I don't want to get wrapped around the rearrangement issue and lose sight of the fact that, I mean, this is a fundamental structure change in how we do business in the state of Oregon, let alone deliver health care and pay for it.
I think that's correct.
Is that good or bad, Representative?
No, I think that's what the Health Fund Board report says. It says the health care system's failing. The state's role in it is diffuse and not very clear. And it's time to try a new model. I think that's exactly. I think it also is an efficiency in government issue, I believe, although that's an untested hypothesis. But, yes, no, I think you're right. I think we're really talking about changing the paradigm, although I don't think it's all government. I mean, I think when we start talking about an insurance exchange and some of the other things that are happening, we're talking about,
well,
in fact, we've heard a lot of criticism that we're talking about public-private partnerships that some people object to and would much rather see.
Right. But the language of the bill, and Representative Kotek asked me, well, is that good or bad? And I would say, as it's written, it's bad, because I think that you're creating a scenario where there's only the winner is preordained in the conversation. And if there's competition,
yeah, you don't want that to happen.
If there is truly competition, you should not, like a real sporting event, you really shouldn't know who's going to win the game. You know, it's based on maybe some luck, but on skill and times, and I read that there's a preordained outcome, and that really concerns me.
We need to make sure we don't write it that way.
Senator Dunbar?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just shifting the discussion a little, you know, if we see the, you know, the goal of the authority is bringing, as you put it, a singular vision to policy. Something I'm not really briefed on yet is the decision to carve out long-term care and, you know, residential, home, community-based care, because it seems to me that that needs to be very much part of the overall policy that we're dealing with. And so I wonder if you could just talk about what you see as the merits, the challenges of not including them within the overall scope of the authority.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Dembro, I think there's really two sort of visions within healthcare that kind of come together around long-term care. And it's as follows. I think that there are, you know, those who will tell you that as we age, we're going to need, all of us are going to need greater assistance, some of us more than others, and how we care for ourselves and our ability to take care of our activities of daily living, of how we're where we live and who we live with and how our safety is assured. And we're also going to need health and medical care. And the acute care healthcare system has often been organized and delivered in a certain way, you know, based on individual services. It's been based on a treatment model, and the provision of long-term care has really been based on more of a social model, and how socially we provide the right kind of care for individuals. And therein lies the rub in terms of there are those who will tell you that, well, you know, let's face it, we haven't really figured out healthcare yet. So why, why are you going to throw the whole social aspect of this and organize it around the health model? Because we haven't figured out how to do that yet. You're just going to destroy what we've created on a social model. And I think there's also a concern that healthcare and technology and our investments in interventions tend to take precedence over the kinds of things that help people every day, be able to improve their function and safety. And so it's those competing things that come together. And there are those who will say you have to keep that social piece separate because it'll get contaminated by the technologic interventionist side of healthcare. And I think there's others who will look at it from the perspective of the individual and say, yes, you need them both. It's not a question of one or the other. How do you create a new way of looking at this? And you know, there's some
we're gonna do is put that on the agenda, yeah, for our meeting. We'll spend a significant amount of time asking that question as to how do we want to deal with that.
And you'll hear strong opinions
on
both
sides.
Ways,
and they'll both be right.
Yes,
Representative Garrett, if you'll take the last question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Goldberg, I was curious if you wanted to talk at all about the work of the Transformation Initiative and the work you've done with the McKinsey consulting firm, and whether we've learned anything from that that could shed light on how processes can be improved. If there's going to be a separation of functions, ultimately, if that's the policy choice, has the work you've been doing over the past year laid any kind of groundwork for how we might approach that? And a related question is, can the work of the consultant be expanded going forward in some way to help us do that?
This is going to be a very hard question to answer. If you'll just take a brief shot, yeah, and then we'll get him back. And
yeah,
I think
sure,
that's one where we might really be interested in getting a more detailed report on it.
Chair Greenlech, Representative Garrett, the short answer is I believe that the transformation process does lay the foundation for this or anything else, because what it does is rationalize and create the appropriate efficiency of an organization from the bottom up. And once you have that, you can, I believe, change it in any way you like, because it is a bottom up sort of rationalization of an organization rather than from the top down. So that's one thought about that. The second piece is that what I've certainly learned through what we've done in this organizational transformation is you need to get outside help from experts, and that regardless of whether you're running a state agency as it is or you're looking at changing structures and functions, there are a lot of people out in the world that have a lot of experience that can help in that. And oftentimes, I think that we're afraid sometimes within government to make a small investment in that sort of expertise and help and get what is a larger payoff. And my experience in what we've done in the transformation initiative is, A, we couldn't have done it ourselves. B, the investment pays off in a big way. And I think it does create some of the ways to think about this, and would love to come back and talk more.
Thanks.
Short answer is it was worth spending all that money on that fancy consulting firm.
Yes.
That's a rhetorical question.
The short answer is we're a lot better of an agency because of what we did.
Good. Bruce, thank you very much for coming, as always. Thanks. He doesn't live very far away. We'll get him back.
I would assume there'll be many more discussions about
this.
I think so. Happy to be a part of that, both formally and informally.
Great. Thank you. I've asked Teresa Miller, if she's willing to step back in line, because Dr. McConnell's got some obligations at home, and if you would come up, you bring anybody with you, or are you on your own? What's your... I've asked Dr. McConnell, who's been working at the behest of OPRA, the Oregon, the Office of Health Policy and Research, to... and he's been running some models on the impact of various... hospital revenue approaches, and I've pulled them ahead of where it would ordinarily go, because we're hearing so much about the impact of hospitals on potential hospital tax that I thought it might be very useful to move it up ahead. And I've asked John to particularly look at two or three models. He'll talk to you more about the modeling system, but look at two or three models for us to look at to help shed a little light to go with all the heat that's been going on in this area. Ms. Robinson, are you going to...
If I could just introduce...
Can introduce him?
If I may.
Please.
Thank you.
Introduce yourself first.
Chair Greenlick, Committee, my name is Carol Robinson, Interim Executive Director of the Oregon Health Fund Board. I just wanted to explain that the Oregon Health Fund Board commissioned Dr. McConnell to create a model to study the impact of a provider tax on Oregon's hospital. The study not only looks at the DRG hospitals who would be paying under a retooled tax, but also the increase in paying patients through an expanded Medicaid population in Oregon's rural communities at small A and B hospitals. The board has heard some fear and anxiety expressed by hospital leaders about the financial impact of an increased tax, and the board hopes that this study will help to assuage some of that anxiety in its transparent presentation of the options available to policymakers. By providing this fully transparent look at the tools available to legislators when you go about crafting a tax policy and a corresponding reimbursement policy, the board hopes common ground can be found to bring one-third more Oregonians into health care coverage, as is recommended by the Oregon Health Fund Board's report. The model you will hear from Dr. McConnell was solely intended to assess the impacts on hospital finances in relationship to a number of variable levers that policymakers can adjust to get the best situation at or close to an aggregate zero on hospital net revenues across the state. It does not address some of the other benefits that the Health Fund Board sees in bringing in over $1 billion, additional dollars, to the state with the retooling of the provider tax. We are planning to provide...
Looks like you should have sold this report.
It's, yeah.
It's obviously a hot ticket back there.
We are planning to provide additional information and research on the job creation that will be a direct impact of more covered patients in our health care system. And we will stay up to date on the federal stimulus packages and SCHIP money that will be related to Oregon's own investment in Medicaid population. So just one concrete thought that the Health Fund Board would like you to keep in mind when you're listening to Dr. McConnell outline his options, which we call the cost of doing nothing. The considerations you will be weighing can't be compared against the current state of affairs in Oregon because, as you know, the current tax will be disappearing on September 30th entirely if nothing is done. If that occurs, the numbers of uninsured Oregonians will skyrocket at the same time that the enhanced reimbursement rates currently in place will be gone. We urge you to weigh your choices against the cost of doing nothing instead of against where we are today, which we consider to be a false comparison. The study, complete study, will be ready soon with a hospital-by-hospital analysis for each of Oregon's hospitals under several of the scenarios that Dr. McConnell has modeled in the aggregate. We hope this will be a useful tool to you as legislators and to each community and their own local hospital in coming to a common ground on a solution. With $1 billion at stake and so many people in need of accessible health care, it's imperative to find a solution. And so I'm really pleased to welcome Dr. McConnell to present the study.
I do want to point out that when we're talking about any of the current models of a hospital tax, we're talking about a tax only on DRG hospitals, and Dr. McConnell will make that clear. There was a question by one of the senators today in the Ways and Means Committee saying that the hospitals in his district were all going broke, and how could you tax them? And it turned out we passed on a note to him that all three hospitals in his district were B hospitals, none of which would be affected by this tax, except by increasing their revenue. I think you will make that clear as well. I just wanted a little redundancy. Connell, please.
Okay. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for letting me speak here. For the record, my name is John McConnell. I live in Portland, Oregon. I am employed by Oregon Health and Science University, but this is an independent assessment, not endorsed by them or paid for by them. I'm here today to talk to you about the provider tax. As a sort of overview, the provider tax offers an opportunity to leverage federal funds, and the provider tax that is in question here, as Chair Greenlick said, is a tax on Oregon's 25 DRG hospitals. These are the larger hospitals and not the smaller rural hospitals. One of the attractive things about this tax is that for every dollar collected, it can be matched with approximately $1.66 in federal funds. This may actually increase with the stimulus bill that we expect from the Obama administration. But for example, if we collected $250 million in taxes from DRG hospitals, that would produce the equivalent of about $658 million. These are annual figures available for an Oregon health plan expansion. I want to start with a little bit of terminology because healthcare financing is a little bit strange, and just want to make sure we're all on the same page here. In terms of what hospitals report and what we look at, I'll go through four terms. Charges are what you first see on the bill. These are undiscounted gross charges. These are rarely paid. Revenues are what is actually received by the hospital. These are also called net revenues, and revenues often in accounting are equated as charges minus contractuals. Cost is something that's harder to get to. We can actually see revenues for hospitals. Cost is something that's harder to get to. We do see reported total revenues or total expenditures for the hospital, and I've created some cost-to-charge ratios and used that to make some assumptions about what different payer groups cost the hospitals and making some other assumptions about variable and fixed costs. And finally, net income is sort of the end point that I'm focused on. This is revenues minus cost. So if we think about the effects of an OHP increase, we're going to expect some increased revenues, but also some increased costs for caring for those patients. Sure. Some decreased costs from...
Yes. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yes, yes.
Because are you using the net income definition as it's in current statute, or are you using net income definition as it's proposed in House Bill 2009?
Chair Greenlich and Representative Maurer, I'm not sure about the definition in either of those. What I'm focusing on is, apparently somebody's telling me it's current statute, so I'm focusing on revenues from all patients, operating revenues minus estimated operating expenditures.
Okay. Because as it's proposed, they've redefined that revenue by eliminating bad debt.
Yeah, we need to.
Which is unacceptable.
I agree.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So I'm focusing on net income. This is analogous to profit in other industries, revenues minus cost. I'm only looking at operating revenues and costs, and for the time being, ignoring non-operating revenue. These are things like income from foundations and investments. Just a few general words about modeling. There are many ways to model a hospital tax. What I'm doing here is at the request of the Health Fund Board, and I've developed one model here. The estimates, as I said, they do not reflect the views or opinions of OHSU. These are my independent estimates. At the request of the Hospital Association, the group from Chicago Health Management Associates have developed another model. I've met twice with them and plan on sharing data with them. I think we have a mutual goal of developing models that give similar results. And today's estimates, I think, should be considered preliminary since I haven't had a chance to sort of further fine-tune my model and to share more notes with them. To begin with, I want to explain some of the key differences between the HMA model and McConnell model. In terms of data, I'm using databank data. This is submitted by hospitals monthly to the state, whereas HMA is using a combination of audited hospital data and survey data. So in some cases, our baseline data is different to begin with. Both of us have different approaches to utilization, cost, and revenues. I won't go into the details on those, but based on the meetings that we have, I generally estimate larger changes in revenues and cost from an OHP expansion. So I'm estimating revenues to go up and cost to go up more than they are. But we think, and we're going to learn more about this, that the end point of interest, the change in net income, is relatively similar because I'm saying costs are going up more than there, and I'm also saying revenues are going up more than there. There are some initial differences on what we're comparing, and I think a diagram here may help. In order for you to understand what I mean when I say the change in net income to hospitals, I think it's important to realize that there are sort of three worlds that we can consider. There's the first world, which is today. This is where we are today. And today, hospitals pay a small tax. It's equal to about 0.63% of revenues. That tax, along with some other monies, are used to provide coverage for 25,000 OHP standard adults. And also, as a result of that tax, hospitals receive slightly higher reimbursement rates for OHP patients. That's where we are today. Then, looking forward to tomorrow, there are sort of two alternatives. One alternative is if we do nothing. And if we do nothing, there will be no tax, no hospital tax. We'll have no adults covered on OHP standard. And the government's recommended budget, GRB, has built into it lower Medicaid reimbursement rates. So a 10% decrease in capitation rates for the FCHIPs and lower fee-for-service rates as well. That's one scenario. Another scenario is the future world with a tax. And there are a lot of possibilities here. One, for example, it would be a 4% tax, expanded coverage covering 100,000 OHP adults, 60,000 OHP kids, 20,000 kids on commercial insurance, and then reimbursement rates either higher or lower depending on your assumptions. You could assume that they'd be lower if you stick to the GRB reimbursement rates, or you could anticipate that they might be higher as a result of the hospital tax. So there are lots of opportunities or lots of possibilities to model what things might look like with the tax. At any rate, when you're hearing different numbers, I think it's important to understand whether the numbers are comparing today versus tomorrow, or comparing tomorrow with a tax versus tomorrow without a tax. And I will show you a few of these. Neither is necessarily right nor wrong, but I think if you're going to compare numbers, you want to know if you're comparing today versus tomorrow, or tomorrow with a tax versus tomorrow without the tax. Okay. Are there any questions at this point in time?
Why doesn't it move?
I was waiting.
There is a question.
Yes,
so
sure.
You're saying today we have higher reimbursement rates.
Chair Greenlich and Vice Chair Maurer, today there is a small hospital tax which provides for...
Okay, so you're making that... It's not the DRG reimbursement per service provided, you're just saying that there's more insured patients?
Actually, it's a little bit different, Chair Greenleck and Vice Chair Maurer. There is more coverage today, and also the Medicaid OHP reimbursement rates are higher today than they would be under the governor's recommended budget.
Under the no-tax governor's budget. Tomorrow.
Okay.
The bond
okay,
tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
I'm assuming 2009. I mean, 2009 does have a reimbursement increase. And for my assumptions, I've been assuming the increase we need is to move, we'll see, whatever model he's picked, but I believe we should move Medicaid rates to Medicare rates, which would be about a 30% increase.
And have you accounted for the reduction in Medicare reimbursement in this model?
No, I have not. Okay, so the assumptions on the OHP expansion, as I mentioned before, there are 80,000 uninsured children that under the proposed policy would receive coverage, 60,000 in OHP and 20,000 under commercial insurance. 100,000 adults who are currently uninsured would then receive coverage under OHP standard. Some quick notes about exclusions and limitations on the model that I'll present here. I'm excluding Kaiser from the detailed analysis since they do not report charges and contractuals in the databank data, therefore I can't do the modeling that I've done on the other hospitals. I'm focusing on 24 DRG hospitals. There are 25 total, so 24 DRG hospitals excluding Kaiser. 32 non-DRG hospitals, these are the A and B rural hospitals. For this presentation, for the small hospitals, I'm just going to show changes in uncompensated care. Small hospitals, the A and Bs, receive reimbursement at cost for Medicaid patients, so we'll assume that any changes in utilization by Medicaid patients will be offset approximately at cost. So the most important thing for them is decreases in uncompensated care. I do not consider changes in disproportionate share hospital or related payments. These are some payments from primarily the federal government, but I think possibly the state that go to some hospitals that cover a lot of uninsured patients. I think the largest payments go to OHSU. In terms of my estimates, I'll tell you here what I'm going to show you, and then I'll show it to you. First, I'm going to show you the impact of doing nothing compared to today. So that's if we take today where we have 25,000 adults under the OHP standard program, higher reimbursement rates, and then go to something where we do nothing so there's no tax, those 25,000 adults would become uninsured and reimbursement rates would be lower. Then I'm going to show you what the impact would be of imposing a 4% tax compared to today under the governor's recommended budget. So this would be expanding coverage, putting a tax on DRG hospitals, and lowering the reimbursement rates. So that's going from today to a proposed policy, one of many possible. Then I will compare 1 and 2. So this would be really the impact of the policy. I think economists would call this the estimated effect of the tax conditional on the policy choice. So in this case, we're looking at tomorrow. We have a couple things that could happen. We're going to look at the effect of the tax compared to what would happen if we didn't have a tax. So this is the first one is sort of like looking at the cost as we go from today to the lower where we do nothing. The second one is looking at the cost going from today to imposing the tax. And the third one is the difference between the two. Okay, and then I'm going to show you the effect of a tax if Medicaid reimbursement rates were increased. Okay, so if we do nothing compared to today, my estimated loss to DRG hospitals is $66 million. So that comes from increased uncompensated care, primarily. The estimated increase in uncompensated care to A and B hospitals would be $1.6 million. So again, this is comparing the current world, 25,000 OHP standards, higher reimbursement rates to world without any tax or expanded coverage. So zero OHP standard and lower reimbursement rates. So actually, I should restate that. The estimated loss to DRG hospitals comes from increased uncompensated care and lower reimbursement rates. So that's what's happened. That's what happens if we do nothing. So if we do nothing, the hospitals have a fairly large loss. The next scenario I'll show you is what happens if we tax the hospitals at 4%, keep reimbursement rates low at the governor's recommended budget, but expand coverage. So this is moving from today to a policy where we increase the tax and lower reimbursement rates. In this case, the loss to hospitals, I estimate, at $236 million. This is about $224 million in tax and about $12 million in decreased net income. What's happening here is even though we're expanding coverage, we've reduced the reimbursement rates, so net incomes are actually going down. This is the one number that I did have an opportunity to compare with the HMA model. That we both looked at the effect of moving from today's world to a world where we have a 4% tax and lower reimbursement rates, and our numbers were fairly close. This is the one place where we've compared, and we're hoping to compare more to see the other changes. Estimated decrease in uncompensated care to A and B hospitals would be $6.4 million. Again, the A and B hospitals are going to be reimbursed at cost, so the main benefit to them is a decrease in uncompensated care. So this is comparing today's world to doing nothing, then today's world to implementing a tax. I think the correct way of thinking about this is, what is the effect of the tax when you're comparing a world without a tax to a world with a tax? So that's the next slide. So in this case, if we compare a 4% tax with lower reimbursement rates to doing nothing, the impact is it reduces DRG hospitals' net income by $170 million. So that's comparing $236 million with the tax to that's a loss with the tax to a loss of $66 million without the tax. So 236 minus 66 is 170 million. So that is my estimate of the effect of the tax, a 4% tax, if we decrease Medicaid reimbursement rates. Decrease on A and B hospitals' uncompensated care would be $8 million. So they'd have some benefit because they would see some their Medicaid reimbursement rates would stay close to cost, but they'd have some benefit from reduced uncompensated care. So this is sort of a kind of a first estimate. This is, again, just to be clear, this is comparing a world where there's no tax, reimbursement rates go down, and there's no coverage, to a world where there's a 4% tax, reimbursement rates go down, and there's expanded coverage. And so my estimate of the effect of that tax and that policy is $170 million. What about raising reimbursement rates? Well, the previous examples considered a future world where reimbursement decreases according to the governor's recommended budget. But the provider tax offers an opportunity to raise reimbursement rates. So let's consider, for example, in this case, a 4% tax as before, increased coverage as before, Medicaid reimbursement rates 35% higher than the governor's recommended budget. This is approximately 92% of Medicare cost. In this case, if we tax the 4%, expand coverage, and pay higher reimbursement rates, comparing the 4% tax to a world where we do nothing, the estimated loss in my model to DRG hospitals is $26 million. The estimated decrease in uncompensated care to A and B hospitals does not change. That's an $8 million decrease. So the aggregate loss here, $26 million minus $8 million benefit for the A and B hospitals, is $18 million $18 million loss for hospitals on approximately a $7 billion revenue base for hospitals. So what I've showed you here is primarily two policy options. One is a policy option where we have a 4% tax, we lower reimbursement rates, we expand coverage, and the loss there is approximately $170 million for DRG hospitals. A second policy option is the same tax, same coverage, but increasing Medicaid reimbursement by 35%, and the estimated loss here, DRG hospitals in that model, is $26 million.
Okay, hold on.
Yep.
Okay, I apologize, but you quite honestly have lost me, because I need to see things side by side. It would be helpful. I'm not going to attempt. So I assume.
Can you go back one slide?
Would it be helpful to look at this?
No, it is. It is with a 4% tax, and if you have a 4% tax, I'm assuming you're increasing reimbursement. Is
increasing reimbursement 35% over the governor's
reduced recommended, which,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I'll take it to 92%.
Okay, 92% of Medicare cost.
Yeah.
So, I mean, according to your chart, the hospitals ought to be, you know, jumping up for joy. Is correct?
The hospitals haven't. That's the reason I wanted these data, in spite of the fact that I've talked to them. The hospitals haven't crafted a model that includes an increase in Medicaid reimbursement rate. All the models they've crafted, which makes them nervous, use the governor's reduction in reimbursement rate. So the purpose of this model is to say, let's talk about this. You can get basically to even, according to this model, with an increase in reimbursement rate, and we've got $100 million in 2009 for increases in reimbursement rates as a first shot.
Okay.
Senator Cote?
Just a quick comment, because you know, it's something we have to look at very seriously, because if we're going to put more people into the system insured, but our rates are tanking and people can't provide the care, it'll be a lost. We won't succeed at what we're trying to do, so we have to look at reimbursements.
Absolutely. I don't think we can possibly do this without, this is my opinion, it's not necessarily anybody else's, but I don't think we can possibly do this kind of a tax without having a responsible reimbursement rate for the hospital.
And I would agree.
It just seems...
Well, you lose, for every sale you make, you lose money and you make it up in volume.
Right. You still lose money. This will take us about 80% of cost, but you'll lose less on the existing. I mean, the really key is this model would lose less on the existing Medicaid business as addition to the new business you put in.
Okay.
John, thank you.
There are many other models to run. We could consider other changes in reimbursement rates. We could consider different tax rates. We could consider the effects of pass-through to commercial payers. This is something that I haven't done here, but the model can do. In other words, we would expect over time that the a tax placed on the hospitals would be shared both by the hospitals and the payers. This may not happen in the short run, especially if contracts are already set, but most economists think that when you apply a tax, it doesn't matter who you apply the tax to, that the burden is shared somehow between both the supplier and the demander. Most of these can be estimated by my model, and I'd be happy to provide those estimates. And I should just add one again that I do plan on working with HMA and trying to get our models to converge so that there's not controversy about the numbers here.
Yeah, it'd be very useful to have the same set of numbers. Then we can argue about the policy.
No.
Assuming we can agree on the assumptions.
I appreciate your work. John, thank you very much. We've got this data in front. I'm going to have for us some data. I'd hope to get it today. I don't quite have it ready for you, which looks at the five-year data and the 2007 data for each of the 25 DRG hospitals in Oregon. You'll find some very interesting things. We'll make this available to all the members in terms of either all 25 or the hospitals in their districts, but it'll give you a sense. I mean, one of the things that I picked out that I found fascinating was over 5 years, the net margin for the DRG hospitals for the years 2003 to 2007 was about $1.3 billion. The estimated cost of uncompensated care, bad debts, and charity combined was about $1.3 billion. So if you can imagine, it would be the extent to which we can reduce the bad debts and charitable care and increase the Medicaid revenue. And we'll have these tables have the percent Medicaid revenue, the percent Medicare revenue. They have all sorts of things you'll find quite interesting, and I hope I will have them available for you tomorrow or perhaps at the next meeting so we can make them available to the public at the same time.
And Mr. Chair, it's interesting just looking at your list. What a hospital that is in one of the richest communities in the state of Oregon is not included on that list. Ashland Community Hospital.
Is that a DRG hospital?
It's not.
No, it's a D hospital. The A and B hospitals, by any of these models, come out ahead. There isn't any way, whatever we do, that they don't come out ahead. We will have, I think there's a separate proposal we'll be dealing with on how we compensate B hospitals that have a five-year net return greater than 5%. I think we're going to have that in front of, I think it's going to be in front of this committee, or maybe it'll be in revenue. John, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on the spur of the moment.
Thank you for the opportunity to present this model and testify.
Ms. Robinson, thank you for...
Thank you very much, Chair Greenlee.
I'm available.
Thank you.
Can I have lights back on?
Good job.
It's clear we're not going to get to this list, but of the people who've signed up to testify, are any of them not... My plan was to take exactly the list the way it is to start Monday when we get the public hearing. Are there any people on this list Wednesday, who can't make it back on Wednesday that are on this list? Okay, well, when we're done, we'll take your testimony. So you don't have to come back. Thank you. Ms. Miller? Thank you.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Teresa Miller, and I am the acting administrator for the Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm pleased to be here with you today. I do want to offer the regrets of Corey Streisinger, the director of the department, who is unable to be here today. She's actually testifying in another committee right now, so I know both of us will be back to discuss these issues further and talk more about some of the insurance-related issues in the bill. Today, I really wanted to focus my comments on the proposal to transfer the health insurance-related functions currently at the department to the Oregon Health Authority. So I'll limit my comments to that. The other thing I've got a memo that I'm going to kind of walk through with you. The other thing I'm handing out is our latest health insurance in Oregon report that I know some of you have asked me about. We just posted online today the 2009 version of that, and we'll be, you have the only print copies actually of
we'll,
that.
We'll get you back to really talk about that. That'll be very helpful.
The health insurance in Oregon report?
Yes.
Sure. I'd be happy to come back and chat about that.
Great talking.
Okay. So I'm just going to start through some of the issues I wanted to talk about. As you know, currently the Department of Consumer and Business Services performs all of the insurance regulatory functions for the state of Oregon. And I want to just spend a little bit of time walking through what some of those functions are, just because I think it'll help educate the committee and all of us as we enter this conversation. Currently, the division authorizes insurers to do business, and we regulate insurer finances to ensure that insurers maintain financial resources needed to pay policyholder claims. We regulate insurance rates in some markets, and that's actually what the health report is all about. We regulate rates in the individual market, in the small group market, and the portability market. And in fact, page 5 of the health report kind of talks about that. We also regulate the terms and conditions of insurance policies, including legislative mandates. We provide consumer protection services, including insurers' treatment of policyholders, which we call market conduct, prompt and appropriate payment of claims, and consumer advocacy. We license and regulate insurance producers or agents. We collect insurance-related taxes, and we enforce violations of insurance laws. So those are just kind of a broad range of the functions that we perform at the insurance division. Among a host of other things, House Bill 2009 proposes to transfer the health insurance regulatory functions currently located at the Department of Consumer and Business Services to the Oregon Health Authority. And I think there are certainly benefits to kind of a under one umbrella approach, granting authority over all aspects of healthcare to one entity. But I want to talk to you a little bit today about some of the disadvantages that we might see if we separate health insurance regulation from regulation of other lines of insurance. We understand that a major goal of House Bill 2009 is to establish the Oregon Health Authority as an entity setting overall state policy for healthcare in Oregon, and we support this goal. However, we believe it may be accomplished in a number of ways. For example, the Oregon Health Fund Board recommended a coordinated approach between the Department of Consumer and Business Services and the Oregon Health Authority, rather than sort of what's proposed in the bill, which is a transfer of duties. And it may be a more coordinated approach, may be a preferable approach to serve the overall objectives of the bill, but at the same time maintain some of the benefits of a consolidated regulatory approach. One of the major functions, and I would argue, given our current economic times, perhaps one of the most important functions that we perform at DCBS, is the oversight of insurer finances. We monitor insurer finances and determine whether or not insurance companies should be allowed to do business in Oregon through the application of national standards. For insurers that operate on a multi-state basis, we've actually spent years developing relationships with regulators across the country. If an insurer falls below established solvency standards, the insurance division actually becomes very involved in monitoring and maintaining the solvency of the insurer. And the insurance code gives DCBS a multitude of tools to address these issues, including placing the insurer under varying levels of supervision and regulatory control, in some cases directing the insurer to cut costs and raise rates in order to maintain solvency. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners, the NAIC, has established an accreditation program to enhance the regulation and monitoring of insurer finances of multi-state insurance companies. An insurance regulatory agency achieves accreditation by meeting standards in basically three areas. The first is adequacy of our solvency laws and regulation to protect consumers and guarantee funds. Two is effective and efficient financial analysis and examination processes. And three is appropriate organizational and personnel practices. The insurance division of the Department of Consumer Business Services was first accredited in 1993 and most recently was reaccredited in 2008, just last year. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the benefits of accreditation. At the most basic level, meeting NAIC accreditation standards ensures that insurance companies domiciled in Oregon are subject to appropriate and stringent standards to preserve solvency and protect Oregon policyholders. Meeting NAIC accreditation standards also means that other states are able to accept and rely on Oregon financial examinations of insurance companies who are domiciled here in Oregon. If we lost our accreditation, other states in which our insurers do business would not be able to rely on the results of Oregon examinations and would therefore have to conduct their own examinations, which would essentially mean that insurance companies would undergo multiple examinations, which would increase their administrative costs. Similarly, meeting NAIC accreditation standards also means that other states are able to rely on Oregon's review of financial and corporate transactions, mergers, dividends, things like that, by insurance companies who are domiciled here. And again, without accreditation, these transactions would be subject to separate review by each state in which the insurer does business, again increasing administrative costs. We're concerned that if regulation of health insurance is moved to the Oregon Health Authority as proposed by the bill, Oregon-domiciled health insurers would not be regulated under accreditation standards unless and until the Oregon Health Authority established all the processes required by the accreditation process, including getting in place staff with the necessary qualifications. In addition to the extent staff with those necessary qualifications were transferred from the department to the Oregon Health Authority, one of our fears would be that our accreditation would potentially be in jeopardy. I don't know how difficult it is to find folks with these types of qualifications now, but historically it has been very difficult to find individuals who meet the required qualifications, and we've had to do national searches to find those folks, and they have been, at least in the past, in short supply nationally. One of the major points that I want to make today really gets to the heart of how the insurance division carries out the functions that I described earlier. We have very, very few insurance staff who deal exclusively with health insurance. Almost all of our staff, from clerical staff to managers, work on issues that concern multiple lines of insurance. For example, our division actuaries and our consumer advocates who handle health issues also deal with life issues. So there are health and life actuaries and consumer advocates. The division's Financial Regulation and Market Surveillance Unit monitors and investigates insurers across all lines of insurance. And the division's licensing unit licenses agents across all lines of insurance. So because of the way the division is structured, which is really one based on function as opposed to line of insurance, the House Bill 2009's requirement that the division transfer to the health authority those employees engaged primarily in the exercise duties, functions, and powers related health insurance would be problematic just because that's not the way the insurance division is set up. While you could certainly do some sort of pro rata division of staff, one of the concerns we would have is that the division would end up losing staff that we currently have that are experts not just in health insurance but other areas of insurance. In addition, the insurance division subscribes to national databases and uses complex and costly software systems in regulating all lines of insurance. Transferring health insurance regulation to the Oregon Health Authority may require duplication of those systems, and of course you need staff to operate those systems as well. There may also be some difficulty and increased regulatory burden created by dividing regulatory authority between product lines. Most insurance agents are licensed across multiple lines of insurance, and the structure contemplated by the bill would require them essentially to be licensed twice. So they'd have to go get their health insurance license through the health authority and then come to our division for all other areas of licensure. Several insurance companies sell both health and life insurance, and some sell multiple lines of insurance. So the two-agency structure would create the potential for duplicative and inconsistent regulation of these companies, and determining which agency should do things like conduct financial examinations would create some issues. Additionally, requiring these functions to be carried out by two separate agencies could result in greater costs for insurers and agencies, which, of course, just ends up transferring on to the consumer. The rest of my memo really talks about some of the drafting concerns we have if the committee decides to move forward with transferring the health insurance regulatory functions to the Oregon Health Authority. I think our suggestion would be that maybe a small group of people get together to make sure that any unintended consequences of the drafting are taken care of, but I don't need to walk the committee through those. But with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that anybody might have.
Teresa, just to frame questions, after meeting with you, it seemed possible that we could create some hybrid model. I'd like you to comment on that, where the health authority regulated the rates or did it jointly with you, set benefit packages and did things like that at the policy mm-hmm. level, and then had the DCBS carry out the operational reviews. Does something like that seem like a feasible model?
Mr. Chair, I think so. I think the idea of having the health authority set policy for the state makes a lot of sense, and having the division sort of enforce that policy, I think, would be a workable model. And I think partly, you bring up rate review. Rate review is, I would argue, one of the most challenging areas that we deal with at the division, as you can imagine. And part of the problem is we can't deliver what consumers want, which is reduced rates, simply because rates are they're a reflection of medical costs. And so to me, the question is less.
Rates are a reflection of a lot of things, right?
They are.
Stock market return, surpluses, reserves. I mean, rates are a variety of things. And costs.
I would argue medical costs are a huge driver, and certainly the primary driver behind rates. And I think that becomes an issue for us. And in my mind, it's less important who carries out the rate review function as it is what are the standards that are used during that rate review process. But I've got some thoughts.
The medical care costs aren't the driver that end up with a zero increase 1 year and a 25% increase the next year. Certainly medical care inflation wasn't zero in the year before and isn't 25 in the next year.
No, and we can talk about the increase I think you're referring to. But I think you'll see
that there's a cycle.
Right. I think what you'll see in our health report is the fact that if you look at kind of what's contained in a premium dollar, 90 cents of the premium dollar, at least in 2007, was direct medical care. I think that will, yeah.
Okay, other questions?
Please, Mr. Chair. At this point, DCBS is involved in rate setting. How much of your function is in that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kennemer, we have two health and life actuaries who are involved in our rate review process. So for a small group, individual, and portability rates, we've got two health and life actuaries that do those rate review cases.
And how often do you adjust the rates the companies ask for?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kennemer, for small group and individual at least, and quite frankly, I'm not sure about portability, we can't adjust them more than once a year. Although we do have some carriers that report quarterly, and so we would go through that process quarterly.
You want to follow that? I don't think that was the answer to your question.
No, it isn't.
I'm sorry.
That's fine.
I should try one more.
I just needed to take a shot. I needed to understand how this works.
Part of the question is how much you deny rates that come in.
That's the question.
How often are you likely to deny a rate that comes up?
Mr. Chair, this is actually a question. I've spent a lot of time looking at this, and I've also spent a lot of time looking at other states to see how our process compares. It's rare that, and you'll see this in the health report, it's rare that we would outright deny, do sort of what I would call a formal denial. What we do more often is when a company comes in with a request that we think is too high, we will ask them questions and talk to them about a reduced rate versus outright denying it and then having them resubmit another request and going through the whole process again. So outright denial is something that's rare. But we do have a lot of cases where they'll come in, insurers will come in with a request, and what they end up taking as an increase is less than what they came in with.
I would say too high or too low.
And that's...
Because I think too low...
is a problem as well.
This is destructive, is too high.
I agree.
I just wanted to follow up. I guess that was my point, is we're looking at this health plan. You know, we have to look at a different model if that's how you're going to deal with costs. You have to be able to regulate them, and you have to do it instead of reviewing them.
Yeah. The bill talks about regulating health insurance administrative costs because we took that language right out of the Health Fund Board report. It strikes me that if we're ever going to really get a handle on this, we're really talking about regulating rates entirely, although one of the functions of regulating rates is to make sure that they're adequate to keep the reserve so that the insurance companies can pay the bills that are incurred in their name. But
and, Mr. Chair, if I can just sort of address that point, because I think it's a good one, and it really goes back to my... my comment about, I think, who regulates rates and the standards they use. To me, the question is less about who does it as the standards that are applied. And, you know, on that point, we actually have some legislation that the department has put forward to try to strengthen our rate review process. And, in fact, 2 years ago, we had legislation that we put forward that would have strengthened our rate review standards. And I think our regret is that we didn't push that bill harder because it didn't get through. And I do think that that's a big piece of the conversation here, and I hope we're able to strengthen our process this session.
Teresa, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Ms. Streisinger as well for
I'm
taking
sorry
this
she
seriously.
Be Absolutely. Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Chair, comment.
Yes, sir.
This is the third document that your division has produced.
Yes.
And I just want to compliment the division on this document. It is a great primer on health insurance.
Thank you.
I refer to it quite often.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think it would be very useful for us to have a review of it so we have a chance to, mm-hmm. to go through it and ask questions. And maybe this time we can get them to bring their black box along. That's an important part.
Well, but at least you have something from year to year to compare.
That's right.
Even though it takes a while for information to
get there. Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Can I just raise a question, probably not for Teresa now, but for us to consider in this realm as we move forward, and that is whether there are any problems in principle with the same authority sort of regulating rates, regulating the financial health of insurers, and also being an insurer itself, providing and establishing a plan. I think that's, it's in my mind, a completely unresolved question and something that merits some discussion.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a red herring. I think we're talking about the health authority creating a health insurance exchange. And one of the entities in the exchange, the language is, and this, again, comes out of the Health Fund Board report, is creating a public insurance entity. I think it's very important that that public insurance entity not be the entity that regulates the competition in the exchange. And I don't think that's what's intended. I think that's... at least it wasn't the way that I read it. So I absolutely agree. I think the rates and the competition, we're talking about managed competition here, needs to be somewhere different than whatever, if there is a public entity inside the exchange. That's a very important issue, and I know it's one the insurance companies are very much concerned about. And we'll have more of a conversation.
Thank you. That was a very good question.
You're going to become an old curmudgeon sitting here.
Yeah, I'll tell you.
Teresa, thank you
Thanks
very
you
much.
Too.
Yes, Gil Fry, will you come? Ms. Johnson, can you make it back on a different day? Is that going to be a problem? Are you planning on coming anyway? Okay, great.
Thank you.
Then we'll just
we'll just have Mr. Fry testify and...
Mr. Huntington.
What about Huntington?
I can come back.
Okay.
Thank
Great.
You.
Thank you.
I think they're staples in the crowd.
And we'll go, we'll start with the list as it is when we get to this section on Wednesday.
Okay.
And I think we'll have at least an hour or more for testimony on Wednesday. Thank you, sir.
Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to be here. Could I pass these out so they could just pass them out? I've prepared enough for each of your committee members.
If you just give it to our
okay,
able administrator, she'll take care of it. She'll
maybe
put
they could pass it down the road.
Well, she'll put it back there, and whoever wants it will rush for it like they did from Dr. McConnell's
okay.
report. And I think you probably won't be able to sell yours for quite as much as he would have sold his. For. Please go ahead, Ms. Fry. Introduce yourself.
My name is Gil Fry, and I've been in the insurance business for about 40 years, or a little more, and I come as a consumer, but I guess I feel like I'm a sympathizer for the insurance company, so I guess I could feel like I could wear a variety of hats, in as much as it'd be consumer, agent, speaking on behalf of the insurance company, and take it from there. What I'd like to do is discuss a couple of the pages that I prepared here that you'll have. So in case you only get one or two points out of all this, maybe you'll get the one or two points that I kind of think are the key important ones. And then I have a number of ideas I'd like to rattle through in a hurry that aren't necessarily in order. But
you could have about 8 or 9 minutes. Will that
okay,
work?
That'll be fine, and I'll try to move right along.
Go for it.
The first page has to do with the very latest news article of the Oregonian on the subject of the Oregon Health Science University and the struggles that they are having. And I want to point out one point in particular, and that is they're cutting jobs and benefits. That's a pretty big letterhead on benefits. In the article itself, on the second page, it shares with you that the pension plan has been cut from 12% to 10%. So that's underlined there on the second column, 12% to 10%. And I wanted to point that out. Are you aware of whether they have Social Security or not? I'm not aware of that.
They do have Social Security, and they pay, as a matter of collective bargaining, the full amount for the pension plan. So they pay both the 6% that the employees would pay and the employer 6%, and they're cutting that rather than
cutting it from 12 to 10.
And so, and they do have Social Security.
So at any rate, I wanted to point that out because a good number of the insurance companies are scaled back to 401ks. And the contribution on that is 3%. So as a consumer, I'm kind of saying, you know, I'm delighted and happy to have the 3%, and I'm able to contribute on my own and run it through tax deduction. So that's been very, very important. I just want to share the difference in those numbers. The insurance companies many times are, I would say, very, very frugal. Just sort of lately came up with that idea of a word, but they are frugal in terms of a lot of things, and that would be one of them, how much they're going to contribute to the employee's pension plan. The next page on this little gathering of stuff is what's called an agent of record letter. Now, an agent of record letter is the practice in the industry of determining who your agent is. And in the years that I've been in the business, I've helped develop a lot of different accounts, and I worked up a list of them, but let's say they're 1 to 12, and these accounts are still on the books. They're still there with the insurance company. They still have the business. But the agent of record letter said that this business firm hired their uncle, who's in the insurance business, and now they don't need me as the insurance man anymore. And so if you sign this agent of record letter, then the uncle can now then take over the case. The case,
like AIG, huh?
The case stays with Blue Cross, let's say, or whoever, Kaiser. They still have the business, but as an agent, I've lost out because the business firm has an uncle who now sells insurance, or a brother, or sister, or friend, or relative, or whatever. Anyway, maybe they don't like me anymore. So, but the agent of record letter is a thing in the industry. And down at the bottom here on this agent of record letter, I've called it the ultimate of the all agent of record letters. Now, I could have called it the mother or the father of all agent of record letters, but I decided I'd call it the ultimate. If the state of Oregon says now, okay, all you insurance companies and all you insurance agents, we're taking over, and or if the federal government says that, well, then maybe we're all out on our ear. But a lot of the agents feel that maybe that's coming, you know? And maybe it is coming. But at any rate, if the federal government says, we're doing this now, and you're all gone out of there, then that'll be really something else. And I can feel it in the wind. I think President Obama kind of wants to follow through on some of his promises. And putting in universal medical care would sort of like be one of those. And so maybe we don't know how that'll work out. But the state of Oregon is working on it also. And I'm sitting back there figuring that I pray, that's all right, pray that all of you have the wisdom of Solomon. Because Lord knows you're going to need it with this project. Because it is an awesome project. Now, I'm trying to move quickly, but I figured that one of the key points I want to cover, which is, I think, critical and significant, and that's on the last page of this illustration, and it says the cost of doing business. When I explain the cost of doing business to customers, I basically say, well, you know, there's a cost of doing the business here, especially if it's an annuity sale. I explain that, you know, you're going to feel it if you want to cash in early. You know, and so the cost of doing business relates to the home office and the local office, which usually has a manager, and then they have maybe an agent. But in the world, you know, the bank has a home office and a local branch and a manager and a cashier. Or the government would have the home office here in Salem and maybe have to establish an office in Portland, and then hire a manager and then hire someone to get this word out about these projects. But I would like to share that what the cost of doing business is from employee costs and benefits. And so that's what I have listed, because I would say on behalf of the insurance companies, and now I'm talking about medical insurance. Bless my pointed head and bless my soul. None of these insurance companies have ever paid me anything for any of these. And my commission is averaged out, and I figured it out this week for your benefit, at 3%. So I want you to know that, and I want you to think maybe to be remembered by it. For example, President Obama, in the bailout provision I heard, that they wanted to slip in there $100 million. Now, I heard this, and it was kind of a flashing moment. $100 million to fix the lawn at the Capitol after, you know, you had 2 million people there or so. And now they got, you know, I've been aware of the Rose Festival here, and when we've had heavy rain, I mean, that's a muddy mess. But anyway, I heard that figure, and I don't know if it's valid. I thought it was interesting, though. $100 million to fix the lawn there. Anyway, you know how expenses can really be out of sight. Well, the insurance companies have not had to pay me for all these benefits. You know, they've been very frugal about that. And some of them have scaled back all their other pension plans to where it's only 3% anymore. But if you're going to have a board, you know, the insurance board, and then you're going to do a lot of stuff, well, you have to have salaries over time, and these salaries may be subject to overtime, time and a half, double time, paid holidays, paid vacation, sick pay, medical insurance, dental insurance, prescription care, vision care, and so forth, whatever else, disability income, short-term and long-term, unemployment insurance, Social Security, the employer portion, the employee portion, retirement, the defined benefit plan, which many government employees have, and some of the insurance companies have the rule of 95. The rule of 95 means that you have to be 65 and be 30 years service, then you retire with full benefit. The rule of 95 is just 65 plus 30, that's 95. You might find that a lot of employees, government employees, let's say, have a rule of, you know, 50 or 70 or something, age 50 and 20 years of service. I have a lot of clients who retired 25 years ago that are my age.
Fry, wrap up.
We're about done. And I have some other comments. Maybe I could come back and share later. But the 401k plan, which is now the only plan with many insurance companies, the employer pays 3%. So I'm just sharing with you what it costs to hire employees, because I know that part of this whole idea is to cut administration costs. And I'm sharing with you that, hey, these insurance companies have cut administration costs. They've been exceedingly frugal. So I think that's enough for now. But I appreciate your time and the opportunity to share these thoughts with you, because you do have a mammoth, incredible, awesome assignment.
Thank you, Mr. Fry.
Mr. Fry, thank you very much for coming. We really do appreciate having our citizens here to talk to us. It's very important to us. We're going to have a couple of sessions in the evening, so folks who work during the day will be able to come and talk to us. We're having one in Grants Pass very shortly, so folks in Southern Oregon can talk to us. It's very important for folks to come, and we really very much appreciate you coming.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir.
And all of you good member committee folks. Thank you.
Any comments for the good of the order? We're adjourned. Vice Chairs and Madam Administrator.
Off to the fourth floor.
Off to the fourth floor conference room.
No. Oh, they're making it more.